Age of Treason Radio. With your host, Tan Stoffel. Yaqui on Culture and Race, Part 11. There's a popular quote I've heard before. It's associated with National Socialist Germany. Whenever I hear the word culture, I reach for my gun. And I went and searched that out. I wanted to find the origins of that. And the page I found, this attributes it to Hans Jost, a German playwright and an SS officer during the war, and translates it more directly from the German as, when I hear culture, I unlock my Browning. And it makes a big deal, the page does, about that difference in translation. But it comes across pretty clearly to me, the meaning from the context in which it's used as, and I don't know about the original play in which it appeared, but the context which it's used these days in English is as an angry reaction to some form of swindle or fraud being detected, especially somebody who's trying to use deceit through words or concepts. And that's the reaction, is I want to pull my gun out and shoot them. To be honest, when I read Yaqui's thoughts on culture and race, I reach for my gun. Picking up on page 281 of his Imperium, from this point, the fundamental misunderstanding of the 19th century materialistic interpretation of race appears clear and distinct. And here he's going to list, as a sort of bullet list, several points, and I'll respond to each as I read them. Point one, race is not group anatomy. And we covered this the last time. This is one of the things that makes me want to reach for my gun. It's a fallacy, really, a straw man that he himself constructed, that this idea that the materialistic interpretation of race says that race is entirely about group anatomy. Race is partly anatomical, and those anatomical characteristics are tendencies, really. They're not hard and fast, binary, black and white attributes that one race has and another race doesn't, and that distinguish the races absolutely. These attributes, though, are linked to each other. They seem to be correlated with each other. A good example of that is blonde hair and blue eyes. There's a genetic reason for that that's kind of technical to explain, but beyond that, personality traits are also characteristic of race. They're also racial characteristics. And Yaqui seems determined to ignore that, to act as if everyone ignores that, as if that's not part of race. And yet the race scientists that he is putting down as being purely materialists saw those mental and personality traits as well as the physical traits. They just had a harder time quantifying them. And even Yaqui, when they did quantify them, Yaqui ridiculed them. IQ is the best example of that that I can recall from, we talked about a couple of installments ago. Yaqui's second bullet point, race is not independent of the soil. This is wrong and misleading. The non-living environmental influences, and I have to be specific here about the non-living environment, because environment also includes the other living organisms that, or other species that a species is in competition with. And that's something that a lot of people overlook when they hear environment. They just think of the non-living environment. They think of the soil, for instance, like Yaqui did. The non-living environmental influences on the biology, on the genes, are relatively small and long-term. The evolutionary understanding of that, the Darwinian understanding of that, is that it takes generations, many generations usually, through many small changes to accumulate over time, to shift over time, to create a division in a single species to create two or more other species. And yet Yaki denied that, didn't like that idea, but he does like this idea of very plastic, almost instantaneous, immediate change due to the soil. In fact, he sees it as dependent on the soil. He sees race as very dependent on the soil. But it isn't really. I mean, in a single word, I can give a good example that's intuitive as to sort of a demonstration that race is independent of soil, and that is Chinatown, and how every town, every major city has a Chinatown where Chinese people have moved and retain their racial characteristics, their culture, despite the soil that they've been transplanted into. Yaki's next bullet point, race is not independent of spirit and history. On this, I think I'm agreed with him. I think, as I've expressed it before, genes shape and are shaped by memes. The physical shapes and is shaped by the ideological. You can see the word spirit and history that he uses as corresponding roughly to instinct, identity, and even consciousness, as I've discussed before. His next bullet point, races are not classifiable except on an arbitrary basis. We've discussed this previously too. The race boundaries are fuzzy, but they're not arbitrary. They're no more arbitrary than species themselves, the various species of animals and plants that we've identified. Or color, for that matter, is a good example to use for race and the existence of race, despite the fact that there are fuzzy boundaries. When you look at red and green, for instance, which are close to each other color-wise, there's a blend in between. And what's really red? What's really green? It's difficult to say. You could say it's arbitrary, except it isn't arbitrary, really. And it's, for us, what we see as red and what we see as green really depends upon the hardware in our eyes. It's the receptors, the actual biological, physical constraint that tells us what's red and what's green. And it can even be disturbed if people are born without the proper receptors or somehow they're damaged. They can have blindness to specific colors. But the point is that, yes, it may even be subjective, the definitions of race, that even people who are closely related to each other genetically and culturally might see each other as distinct, that there's this continuity of distinctions that people can make from very slow or small and fine-grained groups all the way up to large continental scale races. But the divisions and the clusters in that continuum are not arbitrary. They're not arbitrary in the sense that two different people would pick totally different divisions. There is some consensus on it, and it is objective the way it can be defined. Although, as I say, it's personally, it can be subjective as well. It's up to the people who are the members of the group to define their group to a certain extent. Although they can't override the biology, really, when it comes to a racially defined group. Because race is biological, it isn't purely spiritual. And his last point, Yaki's last point here is, race is not a rigid, permanent, collective characterization of human beings, which remains always the same throughout history. Here, he seems to be making another straw man. I don't think I've ever encountered anyone who has expressed that idea, except maybe creationists, people who are of the opinion that not only the races of man, but all of the species were all created by God and have been the way they are since the beginning. I think even someone like Yaki, who doesn't like the idea of evolution or Darwinism, acknowledges, though, that the archaeological record shows that species that have come and gone, and some have existed that no longer exist, that at the very least, even if they disagree about change over time, they agree that things do not remain the same, strictly speaking. So he's strawmanning there. He continues after this list of bullet items, the 20th century outlook. Now, this is, remember, the outlook that he's purporting or proposing and supporting, as in contrast to the what he calls the 19th century way of seeing things. The 20th century outlook, based on facts and not on the preconceptions of physics and mechanics, sees race as fluid, gliding over history, with a capital H, over the fixed skeletal form determined by the soil. Just as history comes and goes, so does race with it, bound in a symbiosis of happening. The peasants now tilling the soil near Persepolis are the same race as those who planted or roamed there 1,000 years before Darius, regardless of what they were called then or what they are called now. And in the time between, a high culture fulfilled itself in this area, creating races now gone forever. This last error, the confusing of names with unities of history or race, was one of the most destructive made by the 19th century, by 19th century materialism. Well, I'm reminded in his proclamation here that this 20th century outlook, the new and fact-based idea that he's proposing, I'm reminded of the Races of Mankind, that propaganda pamphlet that was produced by Franz Boas's students, Ruth Benedict and Gene Weltfish, and distributed to U.S. Military units during World War II, at least for a little while, and eventually became books and cartoons that were made in the wake of the war, and really was the most concrete and earliest and most concrete expression of anti-racism, what eventually grew into the dominant way of seeing race, which is that race at that point during Races of Mankind is that they used science and presented themselves as presenting facts about science, that race wasn't significant, that it was only superficial. And this is basically what Yaki himself is arguing, that it's not physical, that it's spiritual. He's misleading, and I think a lot of the people who recommend Yaki, who are racialists, are misled by his have-it-both-ways kind of rhetoric, the way he uses the words race, but he doesn't mean it in a substantial way. He means it in a spiritual way. He doesn't mean what I think what people who are positively inclined to see him favorably, because he's talking about race in a favorable way, they overlook the fact that he's not talking about the same kind of race that they are. And in fact, the point I'm making here is that he speaks more about race in the same way that the Boasians did, that race is not significant in a physical way. His error he's projecting here when he talks about the mistaking of names for unities of history and race, his own error is in claiming that what he names the Western civilization is somehow permanent, or at least long-lasting, and is what is the thing, the anthropomorphized thing, that actually drives biology and race, or is independent of it, really. It's separate from it and independent of what the parts are, what the people are that are participating in that civilization, as if it has a life of its own and the people are secondary. And this is, as I pointed out before, the opposite of what these race scientists, the materialists, the 19th century materialists that he puts down, believed. At least he was honest in that respect, that he very clearly attacked the ideas that he was going against. He stated it pretty bluntly. So I fault, I guess, the other people who have read, and that would include me, on first reading Yaki and seeing him favorably, that thinking that he's talking about race. And so, yeah, okay, whatever. Sounds pretty good. When you examine it closely, as I have in all of these past installments, it comes across differently. It comes across as sneaky and dishonest, really. I really can't find a better way of describing it. If the present-day inhabitants of Greece, continuing with Theaki again, have the same collective name that the population of the same area had in Aristotle's time, is anyone deceived into thinking that there is historical continuity or racial continuity? The answer is yes. Just about everyone is fooled by that. That this phenomena that he talks about of people being confused by names is a real phenomena. That's the fact, is people are confused by such things, which is why it continues to be used, is because people are swindled by it. And just about everybody is fooled by that idea, including the Greeks, the modern-day Greeks themselves, who think that they have some racial continuity going back eons. On page 283, he continues, skipping a bit here now. As far as the race-history symbiosis is concerned, names are accidental. They do not indicate any sort of inward continuity by themselves. The same is true of language. Once the idea is grasped that what we call history really means high history, two capital H's there, that this is the history of high cultures, capitalized, and that these high cultures are organic unities expressing their inner possibilities in the profuse forms of thought and happening which lie before us, a deep understanding follows of the way in which history uses whatever human material lies to hand for its fulfillment. It puts its impress on this material by creating historical units out of groups hitherto often very diverse biologically. I don't agree with this deep thought. I think he's being very vague here. And as I've said before, he attributes to these vague things like high culture a man-like, a person-like quality of having some sort of drive, of having life of its own and deciding what it's going to do. And he states it very clearly here that he sees it as expressing itself upon the people rather than the other way, that the people, that history and culture are an expression of the people. The history, the way I see it, is as a story that the people themselves tell their descendants and teach to their descendants. It's not to say it can't be distorted. It can be. But that's what history is. It isn't something that exists on its own, separate from people, and drives people. It's the other way around. And he puts it in a very one-sided fashion. He says, history uses whatever human material lies to hand for its fulfillment. And that's another expression of what I said earlier about he saw Western civilization as independent of whatever human material lies to hand for its fulfillment. He continues, we have seen that race influences history as well as the converse. Actually, we haven't. We've seen a very one-sided description by him. We come to the hierarchy of races. The materialists could, of course, not succeed with all their attempts to make an anatomical classification of races, but races can be classified according to functional abilities, starting from any given function, whatever. Thus, a hierarchy of races can be based on physical strength, and there is little doubt that the Negro would stand at the top of such a hierarchy. There would be no point in such a hierarchy because physical strength is not the essence of human nature in general, and even less of culture man in particular. I think when he mentions this hierarchy based on physical strength and that little doubt that the Negro would be on top, I think of his some biographical information that I read about just recently and linked a couple of installments ago, didn't discuss it yet, but Alex Kurtagic wrote and disclosed that in 1935, Yaki was involved in a car accident which led to his being assaulted by several Afro-Americans and losing his front teeth. According to a local newspaper, he was hospitalized, but released the following day. The incident shaped his racial views thereafter. And this idea of a physical hierarchy with Negroes on top is an example of that, I think, of his racial views being shaped, that he thinks Negroes are so strong as a race. The evidence for that is only anecdotal. As far as I can tell, my impression from race science is that there are racial differences in musculature, that it isn't clear that blacks are stronger. That there are different types of muscles with different mixtures between the races, the races can be distinguished by their different musculature. That much is clear. And there's a hint here that even Yaki saw the mental differences in race, where he refers to culture man. Culture, of course, being this spiritual or mental quality rather than physical. And he saw the value of culture man. I've already mentioned IQ as another example of a mental quality, a mental characteristic that could also, you could determine a hierarchy of races on. And some people do. He writes, "The fundamental impulse of human nature, above the instincts towards self-preservation and sex, which man shares with other life forms, is the will to power. Very seldom is there any struggle for existence among men. Such struggles as do occur are nearly always for control, for power. These take place within couples and families, clans, tribes, and among peoples, nations, states. Therefore, the basing of a hierarchy of races on strength, of will to power, has a relation to historical realities." The fundamental impulse of human nature, when I hear that, and he says it's the will to power, when I hear human nature, I reach for my gun. I think the people who refer to human nature are one step away from referring to humanity, as if it's a whole and as if it's all the same. That's the assumption in human nature. Either that, or they only think, when they are saying human, they really are only thinking of a subset of the human species, and they just aren't being honest with themselves or being honest with their the people that they're writing for or talking to. In other words, it's deceptive to talk about human nature. Now, he actually talks about that himself back earlier in his book, and we touched on it a bit in Yaki on Liberalism, part two, back in page 200 or so, when he's talking about liberalism. He talks about humanity and puts quotes, little sneer quotes around it, and describes this idea of it means everybody, basically. And so there can't be an enemy, and there can't be political thinking if there's no enemy. It excludes no one when you talk about humanity, and human nature is, as I say, one step away from humanity. He writes, "We come to the," earlier in his book, he writes, "we come to the fundamental," and that word, he uses that fundamental over and over as well. "We come to the fundamental disjunction between political thinking and mere thinking about politics. All intellectualist thinking about politics posits a certain great non-existent characteristic of human nature." So that's him earlier in his own book. And he's hinting here that he himself sees that this phrase human nature is often used to refer to a great non-existent characteristic, something imaginary. And I think when he talks about will to power being the fundamental characteristic of human nature, that's what I think, is I think it's non-existent. Or at the very least, it's rare. But this is typical of philosophy, at least the philosophy that I've been exposed to in learning about Yaki, Spengler, and now Nietzsche, who this idea of will to power comes from. When I hear will to power, I reach for my gun. The will to power is, from the description that I found in Wikipedia, it's vague. Nietzsche himself never really does lay it out explicitly, but it's described here as the main driving force in humans, achievement, ambition, the striving to reach highest possible position in life, the highest possible position in life. These are manifestations of the will to power. Some people theorize that Nietzsche was motivated to imagine this will to power by anti-Darwinian sentiments as a as an alternative explanation to evolution. And that's probably Yaki's own reason for latching on to it as well, is that he doesn't want to think that it's just evolution, that it's nature itself. We come now to Yaki discussing in the most explicit detail the 19th century materialistic views on race that he condemned. He writes, "The school of Gobineau, Chamberlain, Osborne, and Grant was on the same tangent as the materialists who announce that there is no such thing as race, because they could not discover it with their methods. The mistake of the former was to assume the permanence, backwards and forwards, of races existing in their time. They were treating races as building blocks, original material, and ignoring the connections of race and history, race and spirit, race and destiny. But at least they recognized the existing racial realities of their time, their sole mistake consisting in regarding these realities as rigid, existing rather than becoming. There was also in their approach a remnant of genealogical thinking, but this sort of thinking is intellectual and not historical, for history uses the human material at hand without questioning its antecedents. And in the process of using it, this human material is placed in relation to the vast mystical force of destiny. This remainder of genealogical thinking tended to create divisions in thought between culture peoples, corresponding to no divisions in actuality. The further materialistic tendency developed to extend the principles of heredity, which Mendel had worked out for certain plants, to the subject of human race. Such a tendency was doomed to be fruitless, and after almost a century of barren results, it must be abandoned in the favor of the 20th century outlook, which approaches history and its materials in the historical spirit, and not in the scientific spirit of mechanics or geology. Nevertheless, the school of Gobineau at least started from a fact, and this brings it much closer to reality than the learned fools who looked up from their rulers and charts to announce the demise of race." Yaki wasn't ignorant. He was an intelligent and knowledgeable man who rejected the material biological reality of race. In making his argument, he went beyond simple denial. He explicitly named the most prominent advocates of race science, and he misrepresented their arguments. Yaki distorted the truth. He claimed the racialists had produced no results. He strawmanned their premise as permanence and their interests as purely materialist. Yaki was the one on the same tangent, or to be more blunt, on the same side as the prototypical anti-racists. Like the anti-racists, Yaki opposed the scientific understanding of race rooted in genealogy and biology. He used the same fraudulent style of argument they did, posturing as if he were the one advocating facts and reality, even as he was actually contradicting them. As much as Yaki talked about spirit, he failed to note the quintessentially European spirit, the objective, inquisitive, rational, and honest Aryan nature which inspired the racialists he named. He also failed to recognize the deceptive spirit of their antagonists, the very Jewish nature of the anti-racist Boasian cultural anthropologists he did not bother to name. He exaggerated and thus distorted even the anti-racist argument, giving the false impression that his ideas and arguments about race were distinct from theirs. But they were in fact very similar. Like the Boasian anti-racists, Yaki did not assert that race does not exist. They both undermined race by redefining it and attacking its significance. They argued that science had shown race is arbitrary, impermanent, not deeply rooted in biology, when in fact science was, and still is, increasingly revealing exactly the opposite. They argued the primacy of culture. They asserted that race is a product of culture, a mere social construct. Yaki was not simply wrong about race. He was profoundly, fundamentally wrong. He argued against a biological understanding of race in the same way and to the same end as the Jews do. The Jews being a racial group which is biologically distinct from and implacably hostile toward whites, Europeans, Aryans, and whose parasitic interests are served by exactly that kind of obfuscation and disguise.